First of all, food. Now, we had some not so very long ago, because we all have to eat, and we have to eat every day. And in this country, we have to eat several times every day. In some countries, they only eat once, or sometimes they eat only once every other day, but we eat every day. And it says, well, we should be aware of that twice, three times. Some of us, I believe, eat four times with little snacks in between. Or at least cups of tea, or cups of coffee, or cups of cocoa, or sweets, or chocolates, and so on, in between. So, obviously, eating, the ingestion of this material called food, occupies a very important place in our lives. I don't know how many thousand hours per lifetime we spend in this fascinating activity, but it must be rather considerable. So obviously it's such an important activity to which we devote so much time and so much energy, so much money, for which we require special provision in our houses in the form of kitchens and utensils and so on, requires to be brought within the influence of Buddhism. We can't think to leave it outside, unaffected by our Buddhist ideals, our Buddhist principles. So in this matter of food, there are several principles which can be applied. And the most important, obviously, is that of non-violence, the principle of, more positively, reverence for life. And this means, of course, in principle, in practice, abstention from flesh food. In other words, it means vegetarianism. Some of the Mahayana Sutras say that the Bodhisattva can no more think of eating the flesh of living beings than the mother can think of eating the flesh of her child. This is how the Bodhisattva should feel. This is how the heart of the Bodhisattva should feel. Now, in our own movement, in the Western Buddhist order, we don't make strict vegetarianism compulsory. But well, we certainly do hope, we certainly do expect that all our members, and possibly all our friends too, will make a definite step, a definite move in the direction of vegetarianism. I know that sometimes at home circumstances may be difficult, it may not be possible to be strictly vegetarian, but at least one can give up certain things, or one can give up on certain days of the week, or on certain occasions, if one isn't able to be a full-time a vegetarian. After all, no one is perfectly non-violent. It is, in any case, comparative, a matter of degree. But we should certainly be as non-violent, should reverence life as much as possible in this respect as we can. We may say that vegetarianism, of any degree, is a direct application to our lives, to our eating habits, of the principle, the very important principle, the principle which animates the Bodhisattva, the principle of compassion. But even this isn't enough. One should also eat, in justice to oneself, food which is pure and which is wholesome. By pure, we don't mean sort of polished and refined, just as an extent that there's no goodness left in it. That isn't pure at all. That's just chemically pure, not naturally pure. And we should eat only as much as is necessary for maintaining good health. Sometimes we forget that the purpose of eating is just to keep the body going. If one is down to a sort of subsistence level diet, as people are often in the East, well, one knows this very well. But one doesn't know it always in the West, where we have an optimum diet, very often, to say the least. And then again, one shouldn't eat neurotically. What does one mean by this? One shouldn't eat using food as a substitute satisfaction for some other need, usually emotional. This is what people do. Lots of people overeat because they're using food as a substitute satisfaction, very often as something to make up for a frustrated emotional need. And then again, I think this is also very important. One should eat quietly and peacefully. In a previous lecture, I have referred to that abomination, the business lunch, where you try to do business while you're at the same time supposed to be eating. Well, I think this is the height of uncivilization, this grossly uncivilized conduct. Eating should be quiet, it should be peaceful. You should be able to just sort of settle down to it. And incidentally, to eat in a public restaurant or some sort of a coffee bar where there's a lot of noise and clatter and rattle and loud conversation going on. This, I'm sure, is not good for any sensitive, any mindful person. Because above all, one should eat, and this is the great Buddhist principle here, should eat mindfully, should eat with full awareness of what you are doing. You shouldn't eat while trying to read a newspaper at breakfast time, or trying to discuss some business deal, or having an argument with your wife even, or something like that. You should eat mindfully, knowing what you are doing, aware of what you are doing. Sometimes I have been asked in the past whether the Buddhists have a grace which can be recited before meals. Well, in Tibet and in Japan they do have, in some of the monasteries, but the original Buddhist practice was not like this. Originally, there was no grace to be recited by the monks before meals. The monks were asked simply to eat mindfully. To eat mindfully. If you can eat mindfully, this is a religious exercise in itself. And if we want an example, a very beautiful example, where all these principles, all these qualities are combined, one can't think of anything better, one can't think of anything more beautiful than the Japanese tea ceremony, where just a small group of people, two or three or four people at the most, gather together in some quiet corner, in a little rustic hut, down in the garden, and they sit around the stove, which of course is a charcoal stove, and they listen to the kettle simmering away, and very quietly, very peacefully, with very slow, with very graceful, very delicate, very mindful movements, the tea is poured out. It's handed round to the guests. People sit it, or rather they sip it, and they are just there together, just being together and engaging in this very ordinary, this very everyday activity of drinking tea. Well, I shudder to think how sometimes we drink tea in this country, slopping it in our saucers and so on. But it shows to what a height, to what a pitch of perfection even these ordinary everyday activities of ours can be raised if only we apply mindfulness. After all, you could eat your cornflakes mindfully. You can eat your steak and onions mindfully. Well, you can. And it's perhaps, I don't know, I might risk a paradox here and say it's better to eat your steak and onions mindfully than your nut meat unmindfully. I don't know what you lose on these swings you seem to gain on the roundabouts here. But I think everybody can understand that the principles involved, that even eating, this quite ordinary activity, can be made into a sort of art, can be made even into a way, a do, in the Japanese sense of the term. I think I could say that someone who ate every day mindfully, drank tea mindfully, if they could live like this year after year, mindfully eating, mindfully drinking, well, after a few years, it might well be that they would have gained as much as other people might have gained from a sustained practice, even of meditation.